The advertising industry isn't usually a space that breeds widely recognized voices. If someone were to ask you who the Gary Vee, Tim Ferriss, or Sheryl Sandberg of advertising is, there isn't really an easy answer. Unlike high-profile professionals and entrepreneurs in film and video, journalism, and technology, the people making a mark in advertising can be hard to identify, and that might be partially due to their voices not being amplified to an audience outside of their immediate scope of work. If you're not working for them, attending a conference they're speaking at, or reading a trade publication they've been quoted in, you may not be hearing from them much. Some marketing and advertising leaders have been looking to share more on LinkedIn, a popular platform for advertising and marketing professionals, but it's no easy task to build a following. Hey everyone, it's Noor Nasir, host of Ad Tech Unfiltered. This episode, we explore what makes a voice one that the ad community is open to hearing from and wanting to hear from. And what about if you are looking to share a message with a broader industry audience yourself? What would you want to do to ensure your message is heard? I know one person in particular who's doing a pretty good job at making sure his messages and ideas on a broad array of topics resonate. Tom Goodwin is the head of Futures and Insight at Publicis Group. And if you don't know what that title means, well, neither did I. But Tom brings some clarity to his title and gets into the weeds on what led him down a path where his ideas started resonating with an online community of over 700,000 people. He's also been published over 600 times and has been featured in publications including Forbes, Inc., TechCrunch, Adweek, and Entrepreneur. This episode with Tom Goodwin on voicing ideas that are heard starts right now. Tom, thanks for joining me here in San Diego to have this conversation. Let's go ahead and jump right into it. If I am a brand or advertiser and I have hired a head of Futures and Insight, what am I paying you to do that I'm not otherwise already getting as an agency client?
You're kind of paying me to say no, which sounds quite odd. But generally speaking, most people in business right now have been kind of whipped up into this frenzy. So there's kind of hysteria about how 5G or the Internet of Things or millennials or artificial intelligence or blockchain or drones or 3D printing. There's this kind of hysteria that somehow all of that stuff is changing everything. And if our clients are sleeping at night, then they're probably not doing enough and they probably don't understand it enough. And it sounds rather unlikely, but increasingly my voice is to be a kind of calm guiding force. Which is not to be quite as miserable as saying no sounds. It's actually just to say, look, here are all the changes that are happening in the world. Here are all the changes that are not happening in the world. And that takes a lot longer to explain because many, many, many things in life are not changing. Most marketing principles from the 1900s still work brilliantly. Then to give them some guidance on the changes that really matter. So again, if you're in the business of brewing, then perhaps virtual reality is not existentially threatening to you. If you're in the banking industry, then perhaps augmented reality won't fundamentally rewire your business. But if you're in banking, then something like blockchain is suddenly more relevant. So in short, it's to reassure them and then to find specific things that they should focus on and to do those simple things very well. Sometimes it's inspiration. Sometimes I'm going to get clients to try and do more because they're not excited enough. But most of the time, it's about assurance.
That's interesting because I bet often clients are operating under the assumption that they're getting a strategy that comes with the relationship they have with their agency, and then they're also going to get the associated execution. But the exact terms around that strategy and just how strategic and insight-driven it is might be open to interpretation. So that's where a role like yours can offer a lot of comfort and assurance, like you describe. At some point earlier in your career, I imagine you were also working on account-specific business. When did things start to transition and become entirely insight-focused for you the way they are today?
A broad theme throughout my career has been that I've been interested in the whole width and breadth of advertising. So I've never been someone that loved TV ads and loved creative agencies. I was always someone that loved advertising people and advertising thinking. But that was across everything from whether it's influencer marketing all the way through to digital business transformation to PR. So I've had a kind of a width of fascination. There was a moment where life changed quite considerably, and that was around about maybe 8 or 9 years ago, where I was working at a place called the IPG Emerging Media Lab, so my role was very much future-focused and very much advisory in nature. There was a shift in that the industry was understanding that there was importance in thinking about the future. There wasn't a shift in understanding that there was money to be made there, but there was a recognition that we could add value to our clients in quite a different way by talking about both technology and people and how those will develop in the future. I was getting very irritated with the types of conversations that we were having and the simplicity of discussions that we were having and the reluctance of clients to do anything about it. And over a period of time, I just got quite frustrated and quite angry isn't the word, but passionate would be a better one. And I just felt that the industry deserved to have more interesting conversations. So at this point, you know, people would be talking about how virtual reality will change everything. They would be talking about how smartphones are the next big thing, even though billions of people already had them. People would be talking about how streamed TV will totally change the way that we watch content. People were talking about things like content being king. And there was just a very simplistic narrative that was going on. And I felt compelled to just have a voice. At that time, I decided to set my own consulting company. So it was quite useful for me to be more provocative. I no longer had corporate PR people to ask for permission from. It's just more that I wasn't burdened by approval processes. So I would write pieces saying maybe content marketing is a complete waste of time for your business. Or, you know, perhaps the pace of change is not such that we should throw out things that we've learned years ago, or influencer marketing won't be that relevant for your company. So it would be quite counter to the prevailing wisdom, but not out of this sense to be radical, just because I had this strong need to tell the truth. And slowly people started reading my stuff. Slowly people started realizing that there was something in it. Slowly I'd get asked to speak at events on panels. Then I'd be asked to do keynotes. Then I'd be asked to do much bigger, much more paid keynotes. And it just kind of went on from there.
It's a pretty fast-moving trajectory if, as you described it, you're going from people reading your stuff to paid keynote gigs. So was there a memorable turning point where a significant number of people really started to dial in to what you had to say?
There's no one moment where you suddenly think, oh, wait a minute, like the world cares about what I've got to say. There are just slow instances. So, you know, everything from the first times that you get retweeted a little bit to the first time people comment on your pieces and you know who they are, the first time people use a slide of yours in a presentation. There are lots of little moments like that that happen. And then I guess slowly you get used to it, so you don't notice it. So slowly you kind of accept that there are perhaps movements that are now happening in our industry, and it may be that some of my thinking was a part of that. There are some times when I see people express very similar ideas to ones that I've expressed a long time ago. And you suddenly go from feeling, wait a minute, that person copied what I had to say, to thinking, wait a minute, I guess I have been influential in how people think. And that's quite a nice feeling. I guess that's what, you know, thought leadership is called, and that's what it's supposed to be about.
Is that what you remember the early indications being? Somebody stealing a slide or someone retweeting something you had shared?
Yeah, an interesting part of what you say is the specific wording you use, because, you know, obviously if people say something vague like, well, of course we've got smartphones now, it's obvious. I can't necessarily link back to a piece that I wrote which expressed a similar thought 10 years ago but was worded differently. But it doesn't really matter. I'm not really that bothered about attribution. But you do find yourself now at conferences where people might say, oh, you know, digital is just like electricity and we don't have a head of electrical strategy, so why would we have a head of digital strategy? And at moments like that, you think, oh, you know, this is verbatim my words. But I don't really have any right to ideas. Like, I don't think there's any point in being precious. And so I'm very happy whenever it happens.
One, they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And two, it's probably a pretty good indication that your ideas are really resonating with people, so much so that they want to borrow from them verbatim. moving from there, I want to jump into the topic of making sure big ideas resonate with clients. Because when you or anyone else is on a big stage giving a keynote at a conference, clients may be more receptive to concepts and big ideas. But when you're actually sitting down in front of them, proposing those things in relation to actual business plans, that receptivity may not quite be there. So I want to hear from you, what do you do to make sure that those ideas are going to be received well? And even more specifically, you've spoken and written extensively about the concepts of digital transformation and digitalization. Can you share background on how you've described and distinguished the importance of each and how to make sure clients really consider those?
So for me, and again, these are all expressions that I myself have defined myself, and I don't really have the right to do that. But at the same time, no one else does either. You know, like this isn't science where we have, SI units. So my personal opinion is that digital transformation is to go to the very core of a business. So it's to really, really understand the business model, the culture, and the kind of processes and the product of what is being made, and then to kind of rethink those in a world of new technology and to rethink those in a world of different consumer behaviors. Whereas digitalization is to take a much more superficial approach. So it's to look at the ways that a company manifests itself and to see digital sprinkled into those. So digitalization might be a home decoration store having a 3D printer in one of the locations, whereas digital transformation would be for them to completely rethink their business model, perhaps to decide to offer installation, perhaps to completely change their entire logistics and distribution system, to change the way that they think about inventory, so it's neither online inventory or kind of physical store inventory. So they're very different processes. A digitally transformed bank may decide that it should be a digital wallet and it should not have a banking license, and it should be an app like Venmo or Klarna. Perhaps it would use cryptocurrency in some form. A digitalized bank would just have a kind of robot in a lobby, or it would have a kind of a bank card that had NFC, or it would have a nicer kind of user interface to the banking app. So they're profoundly different approaches that both have their own merits, but they are very different.
So speaking to their merit, let's talk about application and reason for either digitalization or digital transformation. Can you share examples of where brands or companies have used either instance or both?
It's extremely unusual to find any examples of digital transformation because it takes a really long time. Like all of our companies are basically constructed as kind of departments that were perhaps formed 100 or 50 years ago. And then generally speaking, everything that gets invented or is new becomes a new department that gets bolted onto that. And advertising agencies are the same, where you might wake up one day and you've got a PR department, or you might wake up one day and you've got a digital department, and then you'll have a mobile department, and then you'll have an influencer department, and so forth. So what tends to happen is companies get extremely complex and big over time. And to actually digitally transform is almost entirely impossible for these companies. It would take a very, very long time. It would require complete rethinking of everything from the processes to the actual people who work for them. So it's almost impossible to imagine that a company like BMW or a hotel like chain like Hilton would ever really be able to do this. And that's kind of okay. Like, one has to accept that there's not just one way to go about this. The few examples I see of digital transformation, I think Netflix did an amazing job of this. But that was when they were quite small, and that was when they moved from being a DVD postal business to being a kind of streaming entertainment provider. You could argue they then transformed again to become a kind of entertainment company that commissions and makes its own content. I think Walmart have done a great job of this. I think the way they've moved towards buy online, pick up in store, I think the way that they've kind of integrated Jets and Bonobos and other staff within their company, it's not perfect, but I think it's something we can all learn from. McDonald's is quite an interesting one. For me, the experience of going into McDonald's is far superior to any other company in its sector, because it's embraced things like mobile app ordering and digital kiosks. And you can see that behind the whole scenes, all of the restaurants have been rethought, and the counter space has been redesigned for this. But it's not an easy thing to do. So when I am kind of mean about companies that haven't really changed that much, I'm aware that, especially with quarterly reporting, it's very, very hard for any CEO to really undertake the amount of investment and risk that needs.
I'm sure any companies you've spoken about in the past will appreciate that admission. Moving right along, another topic of discussion, one being about a value that you have said many brands tout, that being turning customers into fanatics. Your take on it being that it's often a misguided principle. You said on the topic, brands are important, we choose them, but we don't want to have a conversation with them. To play devil's advocate, when is there an argument for turning customers into fanatics, and when isn't there one?
There's a very dangerous thing, which is, especially in the world of Twitter or conferences, that you have to make very binary statements, and you can never say it depends or it's complex. I do think the thinking that we should aim to have conversations with brands and that we should make customers fanatics, I do think that's pretty extraordinarily silly. But there definitely are a couple. I certainly want to have conversations with my airline because I want to know where the plane is. And actually, I do have a pretty robust relationship with them, and I kind of expect them to know everything about me, and I kind of want them to know everything about me, and I want them to keep that secure. Banks, again, are another similar type of companies where, you know, if you have all of your money held in an institution, you want them to know about you, and you also want them to take your relationship seriously. I just think the reality is that for every bank or every health insurer or for every airline or perhaps maybe a car company, there are also lots of companies that make, you know, pan scrubbers or toilet bleach or toothpaste or toilet roll. I obviously need to trust my toothpaste. Like, obviously, looking after your teeth is an extremely important thing. I obviously need to trust the company that makes ibuprofen, because I don't want to put poison in my mouth. So these are kind of categories which are both pretty low interest, but remarkably important. And I think getting that kind of duality where you're saying this really matters, but kind of people don't care that much, is a very sort of precise balance to try and get.
I also see examples of brands that have historically fallen into low consideration categories who have used customer connection and engagement to elevate themselves into high consideration categories. I think a really good example would be Starbucks with their loyalty program, Starbucks Rewards. People who may not have been taking their coffee so seriously are now thinking about it on a daily basis. Don't you think that other brands would look to leverage similar strategies so that they could connect more effectively and become higher consideration?
I think that's what some of them might be doing. I think some of them are doing it just because it appears to be what everyone else is doing. And I think this need to not do something that's that smart but is not a fireable offense is stronger than the need to do something that could be brilliant, that could be a fireable offense if it doesn't work out. So I think there's a lot of kind of sheep-like behavior. It's certainly the case that everyone's extraordinary. I mean, everyone on the planet has a kind of oddity to them. So there will be people that, there's actually a direct-to-consumer pan scrubber business, I think it's called Sakura, and you subscribe to a monthly supply of extremely premium pan scrubbers. So there obviously are people that really, really care about how they get their dishes clean. I will have some kind of weird fascination over a pair of socks at the moment that just seems to kind of fit me really, really well. But one needs to know when those oddities, if you aggregate them up, become scalable. Because Starbucks has shown that there's obviously a lot of people that really care about Starbucks, and there is a need for a loyalty program. It may well be if you take another sector, like the Quip toothbrush, which is a kind of reimagined toothbrush, it may well be that they'll discover at their great cost that actually not that many people were that bothered about a monthly supply of toothpaste. And actually, again, it became one of those things that was very important but not that interesting to them.
And that point I won't contend with. I think there are definitely low consideration brands out there that don't have any business attempting to become high consideration because it simply doesn't make any sense. Well, moving right along, if there is something that someone who is already familiar with your work is knowledgeable about, it's probably this observation that you released in TechCrunch in 2015. I'm going to go ahead and read it. Uber, the world's largest taxi company, owns no vehicles. Facebook, the world's most popular media owner, creates no content. Alibaba, the most valuable retailer, has no inventory. And Airbnb, the world's largest accommodation provider, owns no real estate. Something interesting is happening. So this has clearly become a popular business model for disruption, right? Everything that you described in that particular piece. You create a network that people tap into, and then they take a tiny piece of the risk on by bringing their own resources and inventory to the table, ultimately enabling a company to make a substantial profit. Do you think this model is going to stick around to benefit a series of additional industries, or is disruption of this new model also on the horizon?
It's a very good question. And if there was a really good answer, it would be a very profitable answer, because to some extent, those marketplaces have been an incredible value creation exercise for Silicon Valley. Not necessarily human value creation, but stock market valuations and so on. I think we're facing an interesting time where those models have basically been predicated on this idea that every company has to get massive, that every company has to get global, that every company has to remove as much responsibility as it can from that industry, because that's a kind of cost and a liability. And that everyone should treat the workers a bit like this kind of robot that has no rights and is the same as everyone. And then by everyone being the same, then there's sort of deflationary price pressure on people to make sure that they're kind of agreed to be underpaid. So I actually think that these platforms have ended up being quite sort of destructive to the world in some ways. I would like to think that we might enter an era wherein some industries will see a move against that. And it will be based on this idea that it's better to find the differences in people. Like something like Airbnb is quite interesting because increasingly it has become a place where all the apartments look the same and they're full of crappy IKEA furniture and the host doesn't care. And what I'd love to see is the opposite, which is a bit like the spirit of the company when it started, but just people with remarkable homes and with remarkable talent and with remarkable taste and with remarkable furniture and people that can give you a nice list of personally curated things to do. I'd like to think that we might see a company a bit like an Uber, but that helps people who speak French teach others, or that helps people with a curious fascination with knitting teach other people how to knit. And we might see a movement towards everything from golf instructors to coders to teachers to therapists. Perhaps there would be a platform which is all about paying people even more and getting the best out of people. And then the company in the middle would make more money and it might take some responsibility for the quality of the goods provided. Logic would suggest we'll see quite a few companies starting to operate in that space as well.
So change gets merchandised and companies merely create a veneer of newness is something that you've mentioned in Digital Darwinism. But isn't it fair to say that advertisers and marketers are often in the business of doing exactly that?
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems I have with the industry at the moment is the degree to which we become order takers rather than partners to our clients. So I think sometimes we are asked to make things because the reality is that our clients need something to look quite snazzy and new. You know, if you accept that you're in an industry which is actually quite slow moving, it's very boring to do nothing. Like, it's very bad for your career as a CMO to appear to have changed nothing. So therefore, you need to manufacture a couple of things which are interesting. It might be you're in an industry which is actually changing extremely rapidly, and actually you can't do anything about it, and your company isn't able to change as much as it should do. And then you have to kind of merchandise things and create things. So it's not... I understand why it's the case that we're often asked to do things which are not perhaps that logical, and I'm quite happy to do them when the logic is just that we need to create a distraction. I think I struggle when people are not honest with their intentions. About 5 years ago, I was routinely asked to make an Apple Watch app for many of our clients. And I would explain very carefully with large amounts of data why we shouldn't do that. And it was an interesting sampling exercise because of the five or so clients that all had very bad reasons to make an Apple Watch app. About three of them were extremely relieved, really appreciated the fact that I'd saved them, you know, a couple of million, and I'd actually lost our agency, you know, some significant revenue. And you could tell it just meant that they would come back and spend that money with us in ways which were more helpful to everyone. And about two of those people were extremely frustrated that someone would have the audacity to suggest that their idea wasn't that great. And I'm happy to kind of exist with those ratios in a way.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into something I just heard you say about putting together a detailed report for clients' consideration. In the case you mentioned, an Apple Watch app. You said you want clients and brands to feel like partners, but at what point does a client say, look, we hired you for advertising purposes, not for vetting out if solutions are or aren't appropriate. I'm not looking for you to instruct me on those types of things. I'm going to go to a consultancy for that. Is there now some acceptance for this type of advice coming from an advertising agency?
I think it's probably the case that there isn't really a new thirst to listen to our agencies. I think there are two things that are different about me. One is that I don't really care that much. My intentions are very good. So if I'm going to tell a client that they shouldn't make an Apple Watch app, I'm not doing it because I'm then trying to like sneakily take them to one side, buy them a drink and steal their business. And I'm not doing that because I get paid money by the iPad app store to make sure that lots and lots of apps are actually made for the first time for the iPad. I'm doing it just because it's what I believe to be true. And if that gets me into trouble, I'm very happy to deal with the consequences. The second thing is that I have a degree of reputation in some instances. You never really know. But there are some clients who will expect me to behave in this way, and they're okay with that. There'll be some clients that want me to behave in this way, and they're okay with that. There's some clients that tolerate this, and then there'll be client handlers that have to come in afterwards and basically say, well, you know, what did you expect from Tom? You know, and they can do a kind of good cop, bad cop routine. But I think, sadly, it's not the case that we're in an environment where our clients are now looking to us to elevate our role upstream. It's different in different instances. So at Publicis, we have the Sapient Group within us. So they take care of extremely significant business transformation projects. But generally speaking, when conversations happen within creative agencies or media agencies or smaller digital agencies, then it's not normally expected that we advise them in that way. Apart from anything else, one needs to be aware that by the time we get the phone call, the solution has already been decided, really. Like a good analogy is healthcare, where I have a bad back at the moment. If I phone up a physio and show them my MRI scan, like I already accept that the solution they probably are going to suggest is physio. If I decide to phone up a surgeon, then it's probably quite likely the solution they suggest is to have surgery. And all of us in our industry are actually beyond the kind of triage stage. So we've already had the solution dictated to us. So to actually have someone suggest another line of business is considered quite strange most of the time.
Tom, I've made the terrifying error of putting together so many questions, but I will have to save some of them for another meeting. Hopefully okay. You're open to more conversations.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Tom Goodwin is the author of Digital Darwinism, Survival of the Fittest in the Age of Business Disruption. Tom, I was going to thank you for the conversation today, but then I realized that we invited you to sunny California to escape snowy and cold New York, so you're welcome.
Thanks for having me and bringing me here.
That was my conversation with Publicis Group's head of Futures and Insight, Tom Goodwin, on how to voice ideas that are heard. We recorded that together at the Los Coronado Bay in San Diego earlier last month. Now, what if you're looking to draw inspiration from Tom and share some of your own ideas in an impactful way? Here are some observations and thoughts I had following our chat if you're looking to similarly share. Number one, stay up to date on current topics that you're interested in. This is seemingly too obvious to be worth mentioning, but a lot of people don't do it. And also, don't feel forced to only build knowledge on topics pertaining to the realm of advertising and marketing. Expanding your knowledge base is an important part of figuring out what you care about and identifying topics and themes that you'd like to share ideas around. Number two, commit to reading. Even though I didn't get a chance to ask Tom about his reading habits, it's my bet that he's a voracious reader. Online journals, trade pubs, all types of books, various news sources, informative social posts, you name it, reading regularly from a diverse array of sources can play a major role in quality idea generation. Number three, put forth the necessary effort to share original perspective. There's nothing wrong with sharing articles and retweets, but parroting the near exact ideas as someone else more influential won't necessarily compel a person to engage with you. Strive to bring something net new to either existing conversation or look to start a new dialogue that people would be excited to engage with. And number four, share with consistency. This is probably expected in age-old content marketing advice, but a good practice to keep in mind. Being consistent when sharing gives people reason to want to follow your work and helps people develop a sense of what to expect from you. From what I've seen, Tom makes it a priority to share posts on almost every platform every single day, sometimes several times a day. And five, engage with your community. If you don't have a sense of how people feel about your ideas, ask them. And when people put forth the time to hear and react to what you're sharing, it's important to acknowledge their reactions and maybe even engage in a deeper dialogue. Only Tom knows if he agrees with my takeaways. I may end up asking him for his thoughts and if there's anything he would add or change. If you're looking to hear more from Tom, he shares plentifully. So feel free to follow him on LinkedIn and Twitter. His username is Tom F. Goodwin, or feel free to buy his book, Digital Darwinism. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. I'm your host, Noor Nasir. We'll catch you on our next episode for more At Tech Unfiltered.